there are three things that Christ requires. First, sometime, somewhere, you must repent of your sin. That's not easy. We don't like to say I'm wrong, but sometime you've got to stand before his cross in a moment like this and say, I'm wrong, I'm sorry, I'm willing to turn from my sins.
He was a person of integrity. That's not to say he never slipped up at anything, but several of his people said things like, you can just split him all the way down, and it's just the core is the same. There are no doubt.
Secondly, there has to come a time when by faith you receive him as your own Lord and Master and Savior. Lastly, you must be willing to obey him. You must go back to the campus, back to the high school, back to the gang, back to the crowd, and live for Christ, even if it means death.
Says that the difference between Billy Graham and some of these other preachers is that when God has something to say to him, he could get his attention.
Welcome to Think About It, a podcast from Houston Baptist University here in Houston, Texas. At HBU, we empower our students so their beliefs can fuel their lives. From our competitive nursing programs to our world-renowned theologians, we prepare our students to thrive at the university level and beyond. And now we join our host, Dr. Jerry Johnston, with today's guest.
William Martin is the Harry and Hazel Chavon Professor Emeritus of Religion and Public Policy in the Rice University Department of Sociology. Dr. Martin is known all over the world for a lot of things, but namely, he has written some perennial books that will last not just a lifetime, but beyond. Dr. Martin's research and writing have focused on issues relating from religion to criminology and drug policies. He's the author of many important works, including the recent 2018 update, A Prophet with Honor, The Billy Graham Story. And I want to just hold that book up right now, and I want to allow our cameraman to just get a really tight shot of this. You know, I ran into your book several years ago. You published the first edition in
1991.
And by the way, welcome to Houston Baptist.
Well, thank you.
We are delighted that you're here. This is an amazing book. But let me also point out some of Dr. Martin's other books. Here's With God on Our Side, The Rise of the Religious Right in America, the companion volume to the PBS television series.
And then Dr. Martin opens his heart in a personal journey, My Prostate and Me, dealing with prostate cancer. And right now, you're still challenged with that.
After 25 years, it came back, but the chances of surviving it again are good.
And thank God for MD Anderson.
Yes, indeed.
So I want to tell us about first your background. I was terribly interested in, you know, where you came from, how you ended up at Rice. Can you give us just a bio synopsis?
Okay, well, I was born in San Antonio,
yeah,
right on the river. There was talk of a plaque, but it's not there yet, last time I checked. Yeah. But anyway, I grew up in Divine, about 30 miles south of San Antonio, and I started preaching when I was 14 years old. And I had a driver's license for a year or two and drove around that part of the country. And then I went to Abilene Christian, then college, now university, and got majored in biblical studies and then got a master's degree in that as well. And after that, one of my teachers at Abilene, Lemoyne Lewis, he'd been to Harvard, gotten his MDiv or BD and doctorate there. And when somebody showed an interest, I had decided in his class, I want to be a college professor rather than a preacher. I was only 16 at the time, but I thought, this is the way I want to go. He said, well, then you need to go to Harvard Divinity School. I said, well, where is it? I'll go. And I did. I stayed on at Abilene, but I went to Harvard Divinity School from 1960 to 1963 and got my BD, now called MDiv. And then I stayed on to get my PhD in religion and society, which was a combination. It was a collaboration between the Divinity School, particularly in ethics, but also sociology of religion. And then you had a choice of a third field, interdisciplinary, and I took urban sociology, and that both of those. So when I was getting through, I didn't know whether I was going to teach in a religion department or a sociology department, but I had offers from both, and I wrote an article for the Atlantic Magazine, And Rice sociologist saw that and said, would you come and interview? And we had three children. Our parents lived here and hadn't seen them much over that time. So, and I knew about Rice, of course, coming from Texas. And I was just absolutely delighted. And 50 years later, I'm in my 51st year at Rice, and I'm still delighted and considered a great blessing to have been there.
Yeah, 51 years. It's just an amazing story. So was Harvey Cox at Harvard Divinity?
I was Harvey Cox's first graduate student.
Really? And, of course, he wrote that very famous book on
the secular city.
Yeah. Yes.
I also had classes from Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Tillich in the same semester.
Wow. Wow. And so sociology of religion is a fascinating topic.
Indeed.
My wife and I have filmed with a lot of the leading sociologists of the world. And so we're talking about the religious disaffiliation that's happening right now, this burgeoning community. Well, so much we can talk about. Let's start with, we began a moment ago with Dr. Billy Graham here at Houston Baptist College in 1960, who gave that dedicatory sermon. Different day in Houston. Every high school bust their 12th grade class to HBU and our Houston Baptist College, I should say, and for the dedication. What caused you at Rice, Department of Sociology, to zone in on Billy Graham like you have? You probably know him better than maybe anybody else I know of.
I'll answer the first question, but to comment on that, about 6 or 8 months after the book came out, I got a call one morning. I remember exactly where I was, and I picked up the phone. He says, "Bill, this is Billy Graham." And I thought, it's the hour of decision. But he said, I'm almost through with your book, and I want to tell you, it's the best book that's ever been written about me, and I think you know me better than anyone except Ruth, because you see things about me that I don't let myself see." Mm. I thought, I don't know that a biographer could get a better comment than that. I certainly think there are people, were people, who knew Billy Graham certainly as well as I did. But it was, and he was given to generous comments, compliments. But I choose to take that one.
Now, why did Billy say that? I mean, because, you know, Just As I Am came out. Jerry Jenkins sat here with me a few weeks ago, and I know that's Billy's rendition of his own story. But as I read your book years ago, I just saw a unique balance. You know, we have a tendency, as you know, when people die, to venerate them like they're saints, that they never did anything wrong, never had any problems. We know that's not true. But how did you write A Prophet with Honor?
Well, from the start of when I started writing, and I did a lot of writing for Harper's, Atlantic, Esquire. That was my professional journals, and I was hired on the strength of that, and that was my got tenure on the strength of that. So I tried to write things that would be. I used to say I write sociologically informed nonfiction for the literate lay public, and in doing, I thought it was always important to be fair. And to, when writing about people, to write about them in a way that they would recognize as accurate, even if they didn't always like it,
right?
That they would feel, yep, that's fair. Mm-hmm. So I thought it's a cardinal virtue to be fair, and I try to do that. So and Mr. Graham said when we first talked, well, to see how I got in, I was writing about different preachers. And not all of them were as honorable as Mr. Graham.
Right.
I'd written several. I had the first article I wrote about that was for the Atlantic, and it was called The God Hucksters of Radio.
Yeah.
And I was going to write a book about the electric preachers, right. And I was at questions to whether even to write about Mr. Graham. But I was writing for Texas Monthly fairly regularly, and Bill Broyles, the editor at the time, gave me a call and says, "Do you know enough about Billy Graham to write an article for us?" Well, it happened, I'd known about Billy Graham from the 50s. I'd attended a crusade in Boston in the late 60s. Then when he came to Rice in 1963, that's a different story. I've got my chronology mixed up there a little bit. But anyway, I said, yes, I do. I would be happy to undertake that. So I visited with him in Jackson, Mississippi, attended the crusade, and interviewed people there, and then wrote the article. And I got a note from him not long afterwards. It says, I think this was the best, fairest article that we've ever been written about me. And again, I knew he's noted for his compliments, but mm-hmm. I'd say, okay, I choose to believe that one. Mm-hmm. And then I got another, after he came to Rice in 83, I didn't even make a point to go and see him because I thought thousands of people have written articles about him. I did tell my students to go, I went, but I just thought I would be imposing. But then he said, one of the things I'm really sorry about is that I didn't get to visit with you, because I still think that article was one of the mm-hmm. best, and maybe I can come to Houston and have lunch with you someday. And I said, not in these words, but I can pencil you in for sure. And then in 1986, I got a letter from him, and it just said, it's the time in my life and ministry that someone from outside and with the academic credentials writes an account of my little ministry and its place in history, if any. Just, that's underselling. And would you be interested? And so I thought for it for about a second, said, yes, I would. And we got in touch. I went to New York to visit with him. And when in that conversation, he said, I want you to do it we don't have to have any control over it at all. It's your book. You look the warts and all, they're warts. So I want you to be absolutely fair about this. I did request, and I put this in the introduction of the book, that I wanted him or members of his inner team to read the book for factual accuracy, because I didn't want anybody to be able to say, well, anybody has his opinion, but we just wish it had been factually accurate. So the book was thoroughly vetted by members of his team when I got to the final manuscripts team. And we spent a couple of days looking over things, and they said, this is remarkably accurate.
So how long did it take you to actually write A Prophet with Honor, the Billy Graham story?
Well, I did just pretty much research only for about a year and a half.
Yes.
And that was broken up. I went to Crusades in Paris. I went to a wonderful two-week conference for international itinerant evangelists.
In Amsterdam. I was there at that.
That was wonderful. That's just one of the high points of my life. And then I went to others, but just the actual, for 2.5 years, that's all I did. I took a leave from Rice. And then for the next 2 years, I was still teaching, but I was spending all of my spare time in summers and weekends working on it. So it took 5.5 years to bring it into the final version. I had expected it would take 2.
Wow. And when it came out, what kind of response?
It was quite well received. It got good reviews. New York Times was a little cool on it. They thought I'd been too kind, Mr. Graham, and some thought it was not kind enough. But you have read it. I think you can see I was neither fawning nor deciding to wield a needle or an axe.
Mm-hmm. You know, Harvard Divinity School and some, religion departments, sociology departments are not real close to evangelism and the ideal of that style of ministry. How do you relate? I mean, between Billy's paradigm of ministry and your own trajectory at Rice and Harvard and all the rest?
Well, what I try to do as a sociologist and as a writer is to say, I'm going to deal with this in Mr. Graham's terms. I'm going to say he was successful at doing what he wanted to do. I'm very familiar with that, and in many respects am part of that, and some respects not part of that. When one of his close aides said at the end of this was 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, he said, we wanted somebody from outside. We wanted somebody who's not professing to be an evangelical, but professing to be a Christian, to look at this. And said, and we also didn't know you'd go and look at all the presidential libraries. But I've been treated very well by all of the people in the organization. And Anyway, that's I feel like, again, what I said earlier, that my task in writing is to tell the story as fairly as I can within the context that it's set, and there are things in the newer version, in the updated version, where I talk about Franklin's involvement with President Trump before and after the presidency, and I think that's a little more difficult.
Right. So, and I mean, you know, anyone observing yes. would see a difference in Franklin's leadership position at VGA, close identity with not only President Trump, but with the religious right mm-hmm. that you've also written about. How do you observe that? I mean, Billy, I remember before he died, received President Obama in his home. Then Franklin was there. And then I remember they took out full-page ads on the marriage issue, mm-hmm. which was very uniquely different for BGA.
Yes.
So, I mean, take me to the point of the update. This is the 2018 copyright update from Zondervan Publishing, A Prophet with Honor, the Billy Graham Story. How did that happen?
I'm not exactly sure. I'm certainly aware and talked about that it happened. Mr. Graham on a couple, and as you know, I'm not, when I say Mr. Graham, that's what the people in his organization call him.
Right.
It's always Mr. Graham, Mr. G. That I'm not downgrading him, saying, well, I have a
sure.
I have a PhD.
Right. No, I understand.
Yes, you understand that. But he said several times, if I were going to do anything over in my career, I would stay out of politics.
Right.
That I'd said to do that and I didn't, and I know I stepped over the line sometimes. And he received President Obama, and I think it was very interesting there that he prayed for President Obama, but President Obama prayed for him as well.
Hmm.
And I think that, I say this without having talked to Mr. Graham about it, because during this latter period, he was just really, I didn't sure. want to bother him, and he was pretty sick. We mm-hmm. had some communication, but not much. But it was cordial. There were others, and I think, frankly, Franklin was doing, this was coming from Franklin. I thought
right.
after the meeting with Mitt Romney when he was running, and almost immediately after their meeting together, a press release, Mr. Graham said, well, "This I'm all for you," and came out in a way that he had not done before in a long time.
Right.
And it was awfully quick to get a press release out.
Right.
There are people in the organization who have said, not people who have said it to me, but second-handed to reliable people in my mind, who just said that this is Franklin's hand, and I believe that to be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Franklin does a great deal of good in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Samaritan's Purse is an organization that I greatly appreciate. I donate to it.
Sure.
And I urge others to do. He does a tremendous amount of good. There are those who have said Franklin is his mother's child.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth was a wonderful person as well. But she was willing to
right.
say this. I had one conversation at their lunch table once, and they were talking somehow capital punishment came up. And Ruth said, well, I think capital punishment is good. I feel... And Mr. Graham said, well, I just feel it often hits the people. It's not fair in the way it's given out, and I just think it's too harsh. And then she said, well, I feel a lot safer in countries where they have capital punishment. He said, well, darling, I've been in a number of places that had capital punishment. I didn't feel safe at all.
Right. I can understand that. Let's go back to Billy with Richard Nixon, that huge political disappointment. I mean, Nixon, Quaker background, really played up to Billy, used Billy.
He did.
And then the real Richard Nixon and those infamous recordings come out. And it's, you know,
was devastating.
Yeah.
He wept, he threw up, and he almost lost his innocence with respect to Richard Nixon. For a long time, he tried to put it off. He just said, well, he wouldn't have done it. It was the people around him. But I interviewed H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman and other people who were around him and Charles Colson. And I said, the evidence is to Charles Colson. The evidence is so clear that you were using him. He says, of course we were using him. That's what we did.
Right.
And but the after Mr. Graham had read the manuscript, and I had told him before I interviewed him about Nixon particularly, but other presidents. And I saved that to last because I didn't want to cut short any warm responses. But I'd sent him things from the archives, the National Archives, that had, a lot of them had been pulled out of Nixon's. But the talking points, the letters, we got to use Billy Graham, his group, use him any way you can. It was really pretty manipulative. And we were, after all of that, I was visiting him, and he was sitting on a couch in his office, which is a very modest office.
I've been in there.
Yes, it's just.
In Montreat.
Right. It's just. This is not the thing, it doesn't have any Six Flags for Jesus over Jesus out in the front yard.
No.
But he was sitting on a couch and he put his arms out like that and he said, I knew what I'd said to the president and I knew what he'd said to me. But when I saw all of those memos and talking points circulating in the background, I felt like a sheep led to the slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was so interesting because I was just, that he was absorbing that, not having known it in those years past, but he wasn't denying it, he wasn't trying to get out of it. He was saying I was wrong.
And we might add that Billy's interface with presidents began before Nixon. I remember John Kennedy asking him about the second coming of Christ, you know. I mean, so.
Well, of course, it began badly with Truman.
Yes.
No, that Billy always wanted to be. He was fascinated by politics. He was always trying to penetrate that realm. And so, when he was back a college professor in Minneapolis, Minnesota, he was trying to get President Truman to send a letter of greeting or to visit or something like that. And Truman just kept putting him off.
Sure.
And. Finally, gave him and three members of his team a visit to the White House, and they violated protocol somewhat. But they asked the president, "Could we pray with you?" And he said, "Well, I guess it can't hurt." So they put their arms around him, and prayed, and then they went outside and
knelt
on the in their white suits. They looked like a gospel quartet kneeling there, and it made the papers that all over the country the next day, and Truman said, I don't want him. All he's interested in is publicity. If he ever asks for another visit, put it down. And I just think it's so interesting. And I've talked to other people who were there, and one of them, Grady Wilson, said, we were so naive.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the opening page of Mr. Graham's Just As I Am, his biography, the opening words are, it was this date, and I was about to make the biggest, embarrass myself for the rest of my life or something like that. So it stuck with him for all of those years. But he did make friends with Eisenhower. And in fact, played a role in convincing Eisenhower that he should run for office.
Mm-hmm.
And Eisenhower acknowledged that.
And there was probably, no doubt, a sovereignty of God in that whole leadership factor of Eisenhower at that time in our nation.
Well, he was certainly the man for the time, and then he visited Eisenhower at the the hotel in Denver at the convention, gave him a red Bible, and he helped with the religious aspects of the inauguration, and of course that led him into the friendship with Richard Nixon, whose parents he had already met when he held a famous crusade in 1949 in Los Angeles.
Sure.
His parents were evangelical Quakers. It's a little bit of an odd combination.
And they were from Whittier, California?
He went to school in Whittier. They were from that, I don't know whether they were actually from there, but
sure.
Yeah, in that area. And that's where he went to college. But then he became friends with Nixon and counted him one of his greatest friends of all of his life, and supported him more than he should have. He held a conference in Switzerland for a few evangelical leaders to see what we can do to keep Kennedy from being elected because he was a Catholic.
Right.
And then there was Norman Vincent Peale was at that conference and came back and held another conference, and he got scored for it heavily. Graham did not attend that, but his fingerprints were all over it.
Sure.
So it was but in any case, he had a friendship with Kennedy, but Kennedy kept him at a distance. Mm-hmm. And then he figured after Kennedy's election that he would not be welcome in the White House for a long time, but in doing that, he underestimated Lyndon Johnson.
And of course, those Kennebunkport vacations with the Bush family, yes, and the, yes, spiritual interaction with George W.
Indeed.
Led him to Christ.
Indeed.
It's an amazing story. Let's, just for a moment, the secrets of Billy Graham. I mean, there was a genuine humility. I'd be interested to know what your takeaway is of the man.
Sure.
One of the most notable takeaways.
Well, certainly he was a person of integrity. That's not to say he never slipped up at anything, but several of his people said things like, you can just split him all the way down, and it's just the core is the same. There are no dark secrets he made. One of his, this was at the time of the scandals with Jimmy, right, Swaggart and all of that. And Russ Busby, who was his photographer and, yeah, stuck with him for, I think, half a century, and no doubt knew him better than I did. Mm-hmm. But he said, Billy has a big ego. It takes a big ego. It takes an ego to be a big preacher. And Billy had an ego, but he never let it get out of control. He said, I'm not talking about a month or two. I'm talking about a day or two or, you know, 3 or 4 days. He says that the difference between Billy Graham and some of these other preachers is that when God has something to say to him, he could get his attention.
Mm-hmm.
So there certainly is the integrity. There are none of the scandals, and part of that, as you're well aware, in 1949 in Modesto, California, they got together the Modesto Manifesto to say we'll protect ourselves against sexual problems with never being alone with a woman, not your wife or daughter, and not lying about the size of the crowd, not raking on the local preachers, you know, they're not as good as I have sent the money to me.
Yeah.
Those things. And so that stuck through. He would never had any significant scandal. But about what you're saying, the humility. And the humility is interesting to me, was the humility was genuine, but he was also ambitious.
Yes.
And that was genuine.
Yes.
And so what was interesting to me in writing about that was to see this tension. And it was, even as one of the stories that was told, that when he was a boy, he would tell his friend Wendt, I don't remember his last name right now, but anyway, he says, Wendt, and he had a nice watch. He says, Wendt, if you have a good watch, people will know you're not poor. And then when he was just a little boy, he would out on the Park Road in Charlotte, he would lead a little parade of a wagon and a goat and the dogs, and he would march along like a drum majorette in front of them as if he didn't even know anybody was going to pay any attention. And when he started preaching in one little town, he had signs that said, here, Billy Graham, one of America's great young evangelists, which he wasn't yet.
All right.
And Grady Wilson, one of his lifetime friends, said in one town that it had about 200 people there, and they printed up 2,000 flyers. He said, if they had a population explosion, we were ready. But even his dean at the Florida Bible Institute said, Billy always wanted to do something great for God. He didn't know what it was yet, but he wanted to do it. So there was always that, and he said, I wish I'd never see myself, my name's up in lights. It just bothers me when I go into a city and see these billboards and all of that. But he had a wonderful organization that's just what they did.
Sure.
And he wasn't calling them off. So it's just it's a tension there. And I think that he was, when in talking with him the first time, I called him Dr. Graham. He says, no, don't do that. He says, you have an earned PhD. Mine are all honorary for people wanting me to speak at their graduation. He says, I don't even list those. Yeah. He said, now, if it were Yale or Harvard.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, he was just, I think one of the, when the last days that I was really, I'd go and interview them for 2 or 3 days, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day.
Sure.
And the last day, it was an icy, icy day up on Little Piney Cove Road. And there's a workman that worked for them, and his wife worked inside the house, and he was a handyman. We were coming down the road, and icy in a Jeep.
Yeah.
And he said, you've been visiting with some mighty good people today. Me and my wife have been working for Mr. and Ms. Graham for 15 years, and I'm telling you, they are the same inside the house as they are outside.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. We're talking to Dr. William Martin, and he is the Harry and Hazel Chavon Professor Emeritus of Religion and Public Policy in the Rice University Department of Sociology.
But also the Chavon Senior Fellow for Religion and Public Policy at the Baker Institute for Public Policy.
Okay, and so let's, the Baker Institute, of course, James Baker, and I try to keep in touch with the Baker Institute. Explain just, if you would, that Baker Institute at Rice.
Well, the Baker Institute began 25 years ago. We just had our 25-year gala in November, and President Obama spoke, and John Meacham and Secretary Baker had a conversation there. And
saw that in the news.
Yes, it was wonderful. But the Baker Institute was, because Mr. Baker was from Houston, members of the political science department talked to him about starting an institute and thinking we'd be able to raise the money for this, and were, but it started small, but now it's a full-blown think tank, and not only full-blown, but it is ranked in the top 15 or 16, maybe 17 think tanks in out of 4,000 in the United States.
Wow.
And now it's either second or third among think tanks associated with a university in the world.
That's amazing.
And the Energy Center program is ranked number one in the world. So it is now a, it's just, I loved being in the sociology department, and I still love that department. But for the last, when I retired from teaching in 2006, I moved over to the Baker Institute and have been there for the last, you know, for the years since that. But I love being able just to walk down the hall and see, so young people, nearly everybody's younger than I am, but to see people who are working on, you know, I've got had 5 or 6 Muslim people, you know, who are working on Middle Eastern issues, and
sure,
energy people, and that health economics, and Mexico Center, and all of these things. It's just such a vibrant, exciting place to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like this is it's a blessing to be able to end my career. But it's not over yet.
Yeah. And your position with the Baker Institute?
I'm Senior Fellow for Religion and Public Policy. The Chavons, the Chavon, Harry and Hazel Chavon, who've given money to HBU,
right,
for sure, the money they gave was actually for the Baker Institute, but I was doing both of them at the time, because I was on the search committee that brought Director Edward Djerejian 25 years ago.
Wow.
So and had a publication in the first book, the inaugural book. So I've been with him since the very beginning. But it's just been a wonderful invigoration for my life.
I can totally see why. I want to touch on before we close your book, With God on Our Side. Obviously, the religious right is a topic we have been really studying, because some attribute the gestation of the nuns phenomenon as one causal reason, the rise of the religious right. And the basic gist would be that we have clouded the redemptive message, mm-hmm, of the gospel by a litmus test of social issues. And those who maybe are investigating faith, or they don't know what faith is, they see it reduced to a certain set of social issues. Now, you know, you obviously dove deep into this, and this probably would be another good half hour, but what would you pull away from this book? Because I'm going to read this after our filming. What would you pull away from The Rise of the Religious Right? Are you referring to Paul Weyrich and Jerry Falwell and
yes.
Tim LaHaye?
And even Weyrich was in very early.
Right.
One of the very earliest ones. This was done you mentioned that it's with the companion piece to a PBS series by that same name. And so their team did most of the research, but I was called chief consultant and then writing the book because they invited me to do that because I already had been writing about that topic, about the political aspect of evangelical Christianity and fundamentalist Christianity. There were a number of things that there was one of the things that really kicked it off during the, well, when Goldwater was smashed by Lyndon Johnson, then they decided the Republican Party looked like it's dead forever. And so people like Paul Weyrich and others began to organize very, very carefully to do that. And the direct mail person, his name is very similar to my accountant's name.
Right.
And I wrote to him this morning, so right. I can't get that name out. But anyway, he was the one that really was a direct mail fundraising right. expert. And they began to do this more from a secular standpoint, but they also realized after Carter was elected, and they one of them said, religious evangelical Christians represent the strongest, the largest cut of uncut timber on the political landscape, mm-hmm. and they set out to do some heavy logging. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the things that bringing in Falwell and those people was pretty self-conscious and I won't say cynical, but it was deliberate primarily for political reasons, although with a number of them, like Weyrich, very strong religious convictions as well, and perhaps the others as well. But in any case, there was, during the 60s, there was the, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. The world's going to hell in a handbasket, everything not nailed down is coming loose. And so there was that kind of reaction to that already ready. And then in Carter's time, the particular thing that really seemed to have kicked it off was Carter's going to remove the tax reduction or the tax not having to, you know, the tax, you know what I'm saying?
Exemption.
Tax exemption, thank yeah. you. The words used to, the synapses used to fire, now they just lob. But the tax exemption and from on the Christian schools, that many of which were started because of segregation or integration, but that just generated a lot of anger, and that became another core of political uprising around evangelicals. And then, of course, you did have Jerry Falwell and others who had a wide political audience and started, Falwell was one of the pioneers in saying, we got to register people to vote, you know, get them saved, get them baptism, get them baptized and registered to vote so that evangelical churches were able to become a political power. And I've said in terms of their effectiveness, not so much in terms of just their, but their effectiveness was, they were able, and to a significant extent still are able, to talk to a group of people who know each other, who share views, to give a coherent message, and then underscore it every 3 times a week.
Yeah.
And so there's that, The left has nothing like that
right.
as a political organization. But again, then what to come up to what you were saying that I think certainly the secularization of the country, which Harvey Cox talked about in the 1960s, and then we've had tremendous response of religion. Religion hasn't died, and there's another thing I study is the fundamentalism in other parts of the world, and Islam as a key example. Religion has not gone away and it's not going away, but in a number of circles, there has been an attenuation of attention and of commitment. And so we're losing the world, we're losing our kids. And so who is speaking out on behalf of that? And so that generates the support. How that turns in to admiration and dedication to Donald Trump is a tremendous paradox.
Mm-hmm. That is a whole nother half hour. We're talking to Dr. William Martin, and we just want to, again, highlight this great book, A Prophet with Honor, The Billy Graham Story. This is the updated edition, 2018, Zondervan Press. You've got to get this. Everybody should have this book. There's so many life lessons in it. And of course, with God on our side, and I do want to close and just tell you our thoughts and prayers are with you as you,
thank you,
face this challenge of cancer.
My Prostate and Me by William Martin, Dealing with Prostate Cancer.
I know that is a theme that could relate to many. We really are grateful for you taking the time to come to Houston Baptist University and share your thoughts. And well, thank you, Dr. Martin.
Thank you, Rob. Very much appreciate being invited.
Here at HBU, we influence the culture around us by challenging our students to put their beliefs into action every day.